Hey, welcome back to another episode / edition of the Engineering Side of Data. I'm Bob Hafner. I'm joined by Alex DeBrie, and we're going to be talking about reInvent. We're going to be doing a little bit of a recap of how things went in 2021. And again, I'm joined by Alex DeBrie. Alex, please introduce yourself.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm Alex DeBrie. I'm an independent consultant in the AWS space, focused on DynamoDB and maybe some other serverless technologies. I'm an AWS data hero. Due to my work with Dynamo, I do talks at reInvent and other conferences around Dynamo, and also wrote the DynamoDB book, which is just a comprehensive guide to data modeling with DynamoDB. So I've been playing around in the Dynamo AWS serverless space for a few years now, and yeah, just made it to my, just got back from reInvent. Was my third reInvent in person, so had a good time and good to see everyone again.
Yeah, no kidding. I did not go, so that's why I had to. Yeah. I've been looking for an excuse to have Alex on, and this was a good opportunity because he went and I didn't. So I was definitely by Tuesday or Wednesday the regrets were setting in, but there's always next year. So hopefully, I went in 2019. Great time. Encourage everybody to do it. Obviously, 2020 was a wash for not only reInvent, but multiple conferences in the industry, if not all. But it's good that it's back on. And yeah, I'm looking forward to 2022. Let's hope I can get there this time. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the announcements, which was what the most of the focus of the podcast will be, let's just talk about how, I guess, reInvent in general, right? So this is, it's AWS's big conference, right? They have some ancillary conferences like Reinforce. I think there's maybe an ML focus one, but this is the big one. This is the one where they go to Vegas, they take over the town, multiple hotels, conferences up and down the strip. I don't know. I think 2019, I think I recall 65,000 in attendance. Don't quote me on that, but there's a lot of people. It's got to be one of the bigger ones around. It's, again, a great conference. This is the 10th year of it. Obviously, it's a little different. We got COVID, and we got a new CEO at AWS as well, Adam Selipsky. I'll try that again. I think the second time I got it right. Yeah, so impressions about reInvent. How did it go? What'd you think of it?
Yeah, I thought it was a great time, you know, significantly smaller than 2 years ago. You know, when you and I were both there, you know, 2 years ago, like you're saying, 65,000, where this year I think was more 20 to 25,000. But I would say it was hard to really notice that most of the time, you know, obviously the footprint wasn't as large. So we had fewer hotels, which was nicer. You didn't have to walk quite as far for different sessions and different events, things like that. But if you're just sort of walking around through the expo hall or through the casinos and all that, there's still just a crush of people everywhere. You know, 20, 25,000 people is still just so many people that it's hard to tell the difference between that. So, you know, other than maybe the keynote size, the number of people there or just a few things like that is when you could notice it, but it still is a lot of people, a lot of energy. I think people just excited to be back in person and see some people face to face rather than just through a computer screen. So that was, it was fun to see that even with the reduced size.
Nice. And how about the hallway track, the one that is always quoted as one of the more valuable parts of reInvent. It seems like it was great, right? Plenty of people to talk to.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's my favorite part of reInvent, you know, you and I being here from Omaha, you know, there are some tech people, we've got the AWS meetup. There's nothing quite like just really getting to interact with so many people from the AWS and tech community. So, I mean, honestly, the last two reInvents I've gone to one session each time. I go to Rick Houlihan's session every time. And other than that, I mostly just do hallway track and meet with people, see what they're working on, what they're excited about, different things like that. So it was great as always to eat some food and just talk with people.
Nice. And Rick, he's the one that usually does the big one around DynamoDB. Is that correct? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yep. He's the DynamoDB expert within AWS. So he helped a ton of Amazon.com and AWS services switch from Oracle, relational, all that stuff into DynamoDB and NoSQL, and then it helps a lot of external customers with that as well. And then he just has an awesome talk every year, just teaching some of those principles that he helps with customers. So
nice.
Just a mind blowing cool talk every year.
Nice. That's really good. And you gave a talk as well, again this year, right?
Yeah. That's true. Yep. So yeah, this is my third year giving a talk. It's another DynamoDB data modeling talk. So I always like to say that Rick's talk is like a like an 800 level talk. It's like a PhD level talk in DynamoDB data modeling. And I try to fill like the 200, 300, 400, somewhere level gap in there to where if you're brand new, we'll teach you some of that stuff. We'll also teach you sort of the intermediate and early expert type stuff, just so you can sort of translate and understand what Rick's talking about. Because I think the stuff that Rick's doing is really cool, but it's hard if that's the first time seeing it. So I try to bridge that gap between, hey, I'm brand new here, I've done relational modeling, and Rick's superhero level stuff.
Yeah, I remember watching one of his talks. It probably was 2018, when he was, again, like he's like just a perennial favorite there, right? And yeah, that was without any prior knowledge of DynamoDB or very little. And it was a bit rough to grasp some of the concepts. He kind of hits the ground running and yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I just remember the first time I listened to it on a podcast. They used to release these in podcast form, and I'm driving to work, listening to this podcast. And at the end of that podcast, I knew two things. Number one, I was using Dynamo completely incorrectly. And number two, I still had no idea how to use it correctly. Like, I'm going to have to go watch that talk like six more times to figure it out. And I did. Like, I just kept watching that talk. But it takes a few times that first time.
Can imagine. So, yeah. All right. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Let's get into the announcements then.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So a big, at least from a data perspective, one of the big ones that came out in Adam's keynote, Adam Selipsky, was around the serverless, the new serverless offerings for the data products, right? So we had Redshift, EMR, MSK. So that's the Kafka, the managed Kafka, which is now serverless, or actually has a serverless option to it. And then Kinesis, which is a little bit different than the other three, but we'll get into that. So starting off with Redshift, again, new serverless option. It's their data warehouse, their MPP, their massively parallel processing database, data warehouse that they have in place. It's been around for a long time, very popular, widely used. And it was a managed service. It still is a managed service. But in order to set one of these things up, you had to do quite a bit of planning, right? You had to pick out your nodes. You had to spec those nodes out, storage, things like that. It wasn't a turnkey type operation. But now with serverless, you get a lot of that is handled for you, right? So it's a big weight off the provisioning aspect of getting Redshift up and running, right? I think that this is obvious, in my opinion, an obvious response to the popularity of Snowflake and even maybe to some extent BigQuery over at Google. But I think it's a great win for AWS and helps close that gap. Again, Redshift is very popular. I think this will even further its popularity in the industry. And again, you don't have to do none of the node types, node counts, workload management. You don't have to worry about the scaling aspect. That's all handled for you. You can create your own databases and populate them with the data, or you can tap into existing data shares for Redshift. And you can even restore a snapshot from one of your provision Redshift clusters. So it's all pretty neat. I'm looking forward to diving into it. I think with all of these things, look at the pricing, make sure it makes sense. Obviously, with serverless, that becomes a little higher cost, but hopefully the big trade-off is that you'll spend less time managing that cluster or speccing it out. So hopefully it's a big win for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty curious to see how it all works out. You know, some of these things, the devil's in the details around pricing and performance and all that stuff. But I think moving to that more serverless, both a billing model and an operational model is pretty interesting. You know, I was a big fan of Redshift at some prior jobs where we used that. And, you know, I think especially that workload management, that was always a key piece. How do you sort of segment these long running beefy queries from other, you know, smaller, quicker queries and not sort of have one person jam up the whole cluster. So I think especially if they can do something pretty efficient around that, that's going to be great. It'll also be interesting, I think, to see where this ends up fitting between, you know, the traditional provisioned Redshift and then something like Athena, right? And sort of where it fits on that cost performance curve and what sort of use cases make sense in provision, what sort of use cases make sense in serverless Redshift, and then what sorts makes sense in Athena. Yeah. So it'll be, you know, just interesting to see that shake out over the next year, 2-3 years.
I agree. Absolutely. Next up is EMR serverless. So EMR is another one of those long standing managed services. You know, it kind of bundles popular open source, big data tools, things like Spark, Hive, Presto, things like that. And it's had this managed look for so long, and it certainly made things, make managing distributed data systems like all those things, Hadoop, Hive, again, Presto, those are obviously not trivial to manage. So it really helped out in the beginning. But now we have this serverless option, right? Even less to deal with, less to spec out, things of that nature. You basically submit a job to this EMR serverless, and it will scale up and scale down as needed. It will even scale up during the job too, right? So if you have certain aspects of a job or an application, it will say, okay, you need 2 executors at first, and then you need 5, and then we can go back to 2, things like that. So it sounds like it's going to be quite the advancement for people in that space.
Yeah, for sure. I love this one. I love this even more than the Redshift serverless one. Again, same place when I was back at Huddle, we used a lot of Redshift and EMR type stuff. And like you're saying, EMR makes it just so much easier to deal with these giant distributed systems that you need to coordinate and configure in a certain way. And, you know, if you want to use something like Spark, so much easier to use a managed service rather than configuring that yourself. And the ability now to just say, hey, run this job, you figure out how many nodes I need, or maybe I just drop you in a thing saying this many executors or whatever, scale up and down during a job. Because we used to have multi-step jobs, and sometimes we'd spin up a giant cluster, 100 machines, yeah, and need that for the first part and not need it down the road once we've reduced it down a little bit. So being able to save some money there, just save some operational burden. I love this idea. Really glad to see that out there.
Yeah, and much like your comparison, or you brought up that idea of, you know, how will it fit in with Athena, right? And some other things out there, right? I think we have a similar thing with EMR serverless and also with Glue, right? You could see that you could do very similar things if, you know, cause Glue, for if you don't know, is like serverless Spark. It's a great product. It's adding new features all the time, but now you can run Spark and EMR, and you can just spin it up for a particular job, much the same way you do with Glue. I think that Glue has, you know, tighter integrations with the catalog, with the crawling aspect of it, maybe some easier connections out of the box, but it is a similar problem. It'll be interesting to see, you know, now that we have this new option for EMR serverless, you know, which way people will go, or, you know, if they say, well, EMR is such a burden, I was thinking about going to Glue, but now I can stay with EMR and the stack and keep a lot of the same, I guess, frameworks and code.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's gonna be fun to see and see what's possible there for sure.
Yeah. Next up is the MSK, so managed Kafka, right? So this is a fairly new service. I remember this coming up in 2019, right? Maybe possibly at 2019 reInvent that they came out with managed Kafka. And it was, you know, it was a little bit at that time, it was like, hey, we got Kinesis, right? But now we have Kafka, right? And we have this managed version. It took a lot of the headache away again with a lot of these managed things. But now we have serverless, right? You don't have to worry about it again. So kind of a broken record, but you're not specking out nodes. You're not provisioning things up front. None of that. You just go with the serverless option. Again, make sure you get the calculator out, check those prices,
yep,
to make sure that it's going to be a good move and you understand the trade-offs.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of curious to jump the gun a bit, but to juxtapose this with Kinesis On Demand, right? You have two different managed stream offerings. It's interesting that for Kafka, they're calling it Kafka Serverless, and then for Kinesis, they're calling it Kinesis On Demand. I haven't dug too deeply into those differences. I guess I don't know if the Kafka one scales to zero and maybe Kinesis doesn't. And maybe it seems weird that they could scale one to zero and not the other one, since they're both basically, you know, stream abstractions for you. So
I think that's a valid concern or a question, right? And to my understanding, I don't quote that, but I think the managed Kafka, the serverless option, you can scale to zero. There is no, at least from a cost perspective, you're only paying for what you use. So kind of a true serverless type of a billing type of an approach. But with Kinesis On Demand, there isn't that. There is this base level of cost that you will incur regardless of the volume that you're using. And I think that when it was announced and, you know, I was checking some Twitter reactions and things like that. It seemed the consensus, okay, this is great. But in reality, it's auto-scaling. Maybe it's best to definitely get the calculator out, double-check the math. Mm-hmm. You might find with the majority of the situations out there that you should just over-provision with the traditional Kinesis data streams product, right? Maybe you have some use cases where spikes are wildly unpredictable and there's no way for me to figure out what to provision. Maybe it's a good option. There may be some stuff over there I'm overlooking. I think it'll become apparent. Again, a lot of these things are in preview too, so it's very new. A lot of the, I'm sure yep. there'll be subsequent blog posts that will shed some light. Some industry experts will be digging in, things like that. But that one out of, they lumped it in with the serverless announcements, but it's definitely on demand. Different, similar, but yeah, watch out for that one in particular on the pricing.
Yeah, for sure. I'll be curious to see. I'm sure someone will come up with a handy calculator to help you figure out, what's your sort of daily throughput and what's your peak throughput within the day, and say, okay, you should be using on demand or you should be using pre-provision, because like you're saying, it has that sort of, what is that, minimum charge of maybe $30 a month or something like that, which. Yep. It doesn't seem too much in the context of some bills, but when you're talking about these serverless offerings where you have API Gateway, yeah. Lambda, Dynamo, all on demand and pay per use, some people's yeah. monthly bill is less than $30 a yeah. month. So,
in lower environments too, right? If you want to have exactly. sandbox stuff, QA dev, that's the appeal. There's a lot of it to appeal about serverless, but that in particular, that ability just to have environments and you're not paying for them because you're not running things through Lambda or Kafka, yep. but with these, there's a minimum charge every month. That's definitely a gotcha. So,
yep. So that's interesting that it came out that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Let's move on to, our second grouping of announcements that we're talking about, which is the, serverless friendly additions, right? So I'll let you take that one on.
Yeah, sure. So I think you led off pretty well with, serverless data type stuff and some different data offerings. I think they also have some nice things in the world of maybe serverless compute, serverless integrations, if you want to talk about things like that. So four big ones that came out that I like, and I think most of these actually came out even before reInvent happened. But one of them is setting up filters for some of these connections of Lambda functions to different event sources. So they had for DynamoDB streams, Kinesis streams, SQS queues, you can actually set up filters on that configuration to filter out messages that don't match a particular pattern. And then those messages won't be sent to your Lambda function for processing. So I know, especially on that DynamoDB nice. Stream side, this is something that people have been asking for a while. I've been looking for, especially if you're doing, single table design with Dynamo, you have a lot of different entity types in a single table, and maybe you only want to operate on certain entity types, right? Maybe only customers, maybe only orders or inventory items, something like that. And you just have to filter through all these different types of items. Well, now you can do that, instead of doing it in your Lambda function, you can do it at that event source connection level. Oh. Just say, hey, don't give me those items I don't care about. Give me these ones I do care about. And I can go from there, which is pretty interesting.
That sounds like a nice add. Those are the great ones you hear about in reInvent that may not get all the claps, but it's like, oh, this is perfect, right?
Exactly. Just like continuing to improve and level up on those services. And another one, and this is like honestly probably my favorite announcement from reInvent or darn near it, is the SQS partial batch response. So just for a little background there, Amazon SQS, this is Amazon's queue service, right? You can enqueue some messages and then consumers can read them off and delete them from the queue once they're processed. Has a really great integration with Lambda functions. So actually using SQS queues and Lambda functions is one of my best favorite use cases for Lambda functions, because you can sort of scale up your worker fleet very easily and process those as you want to. But when you're working with SQSQs and a Lambda function, you can configure a batch of messages from SQS to invoke your Lambda function. So maybe your Lambda function gets 10 SQS messages. Now, as you're processing those, if all those messages succeed, you can just return successful from your Lambda function, and that integration will manage like to delete all those different messages for you. However, if sort of one of those messages fails or a couple of messages fail, previously you had to basically just fail that response and it wouldn't delete those messages for you. And then in your Lambda function, you had to delete the ones that succeeded. So you sort of had like this bifurcated approach, like what happens if part of my batch succeeds or all of my batch succeeds. Now they've set it up to where you can just indicate in your response from your Lambda function which ones succeed and which ones failed, and they'll handle partial failures for you. You don't need to do that in your function. It really simplifies your logic that way, and it puts more of that onto the service and something that service should be doing.
So like a transaction of sorts, right? You can specify it's either all or nothing in some respects. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, now you can actually do partial. Yeah. Like it used to be sort of all or nothing, and now gives you a little more fine-grained ability on that without you doing stuff in your Lambda function. So honestly, that's a huge improvement to where rather than making a bunch of API calls in your Lambda function to delete messages, you can just return a response and say, hey, these are the ones to get rid of, and it works really well. So huge improvement. Another huge related improvement is just dead letter queue management with SQS. So with SQS, you know, you can configure it to have a dead letter queue where if you receive a message but don't delete it too many times, you know, they might just assume something is wrong with that message and then shuttle it off to a dead letter queue. They've added some niceties around that. It sounds like it's only AWS console based for now, but I'm hoping they'll change it later, where you can re-enqueue those messages. So what'll often happen is you have some messages in your queue, they're failing in your Lambda function, maybe you have an error in your logic, and because of that, they get to your DL queue. You figure out that error in your logic and you fix that in your Lambda function, but now you have all these messages in your DL queue. You can send those back to that original SQS queue and they'll get processed with that new logic and get through there. Makes it a lot easier to deal with those sort of failures and things like that. Or even if you had transient failures, you know, just some downstream system, you could redrive those back to your original queue and get rolling.
Anything that helps accommodate or help out when things don't go as to plan, right? Anything that you get off the happy path, it's nice to have those types of utilities. Obviously the DLQ is that, you know, that's been been around for a long time, but this ability to, you know, requeue those items, that's pretty slick.
Yeah. And honestly, like the last like three places I've worked, we've had like a internal CLI tool that would basically do this, but now you like need to get administrative credentials and run it from your local machine to say, hey, get everything from my DLQ and send it to the original one. And what if you mistype it or something like that? So now, you know, it's nice that they're doing that for you. They know what the original queue that it came from is, and you can send it right to that. It's really a nice deal there. So
nice.
Yeah. And then the last thing, you know, if we're talking about serverless compute, you know, another small change, but something that's going to be pretty interesting is now you can send S3 event notifications directly to EventBridge. So S3 event notifications, you know, S3 is like your object store, your blob store, if you have log files going there or different things like that. You know, when a file gets in there, you can configure a notification to send that event somewhere and basically say, hey, we got this new file, go do something with it. And you can do that to a Lambda function, SQSQ, SNS topic. Now they let you send it to EventBridge, which is like this sort of central event bus and things like that. And it gives you nice fan out on that S3 event. So it's easy to send it to a lot of places. And I know a lot of people were basically taking that S3 event, sending it to a Lambda function, and that Lambda would just write to EventBridge. And now just taking that out and being able to send it to EventBridge immediately, big deal there. So I love that. And again, I think all four of these are all just in that world of, hey, let's make these integrations easier. A lot of times we don't need Lambda doing something super basic. If a lot of people are doing the same basic thing in a Lambda, let's turn that into configuration rather than the code. And that's pretty nice for all four of these.
Nice. Very nice. We also had some DynamoDB announcements, right? And that's definitely an area of interest to you, from what I understand.
Yeah, sure. You know, I love Dynamo and I love the stuff they're doing there. So just a few quick ones. You know, the stream filtering for Lambda connections, we already talked about that a bit. But basically, again, if you're using DynamoDB streams, which is basically change data capture for Dynamo, right? Every time you do a write operation to your Dynamo table, you're inserting an item, updating an item, deleting an item, they'll put a record into that stream and you can react to that with Lambda functions or all sorts of different things. But now you have a filtering mechanism to say, hey, I only care about this type of entity, or I only care about delete events, or I only care about updates or something like that, and filter out those other ones rather than doing your Lambda function. So that's a nice one. I think one that people have been looking for a while. Two other interesting ones. They now allow you to do cross account backup and recovery, which is pretty interesting. You know, we're seeing a lot more cross account stuff in AWS. You're seeing more multi-account architectures, whether you're splitting between, you know, dev staging prod or whether you're splitting across functionality. Now you can have your backups go into a different account. You can actually have a backup go to a different account and then restore that table into that separate account. So that could set up some interesting staging type opportunities, right? If you want to take a copy of prod data, pull it into staging, maybe you then obfuscate it in some way, but you actually have your full table rather than just sort of some faked data in there. So I think that's pretty interesting. Or if you want to have an account that's just for backups, you know, and controls your backups, you have limited control on who can access those backups and delete those backups, things like that. Pretty interesting that way. So I like that they pulled that in. The last thing on Dynamo 2, they also introduced a new storage class, which I think this is super interesting. You don't see a lot of different like storage classes, you know, it's sort of like an S3 thing, but, with Dynamo, they basically added a different billing model with this storage class. So just in a brief way, Dynamo is built on sort of two axes, right? You build on the actual storage in your table, and then you build on the throughput against your table, which is how many reads are you doing, how big are those reads, how many writes are you doing, how big are those writes, things like that. They've added this new storage class now that has a lower storage cost and a higher throughput cost, which is interesting to see. I would say most people I talk to, you know, their throughput dominates their actual DynamoDB bill, so storage isn't a big deal. But if you have these access patterns where you're writing a lot of data and it's often quickly, you know, I wouldn't say stale or completely out of date, but just read a lot less frequently after it's written. You know, if you have like a delivery platform, if you think of like Grubhub or DoorDash or Instacart or whatever, you know, you create this order, it's maybe updated a bunch of times in the first, 15, 30 minutes that it's active. Maybe you view it for the next day or week, but then after that, it's not really viewed that often unless you're going deep in your history. So being able to like segment that data off into a different table and store a lot or save a lot on that storage and just pay a slightly higher cost if you, those few times you do need to access it, can save some money. So
yeah,
I like the way I would say it is, I think this is big news for a small number of customers, right? There's a small number of customers that have those unique needs and have giant DynamoDB tables where saving on storage is going to help them. I don't think it's a game changer for like a lot of people, but I think for those people, it's just going to be a huge deal for them and save them a lot.
I could see that. Absolutely. And may bring in some folks that have otherwise been hesitant, right? You have this generic, you know, this across the board rate that you'd have to pay regardless of, your throughput. I could see that. Definitely. You know, things like, well, of course, you know, you're going to have high throughput on orders, but customer locations, maybe not so much. So I think that could be beneficial.
Yeah.
That's a great addition.
Yeah.
And just such a interesting way to charge for different throughput rates on a single DB. That's crazy.
Yep. I know. It is interesting. You know, it reminds me of S3, where S3 has these different storage classes, but it seems more doable in S3, you know, where it's a little bit colder data than sort of a hot database like DynamoDB. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that they can do this sort of thing. And just sort of the magic they're doing under the hood with that is pretty interesting.
Yeah. That's definitely one to watch to see the use cases come about on that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah.
That's okay. We'll move on to our last category here with price decreases. You know, when we were talking about this, recording this pod, you'd brought up an interesting fact that, you know, maybe price decrease announcements haven't been around so much lately in reinvents in the past 5 to 7 years, but now they're back. So good news for the wallet.
I suppose so. You know, it was interesting. I think for the first, you know, this is the 10th reInvent, but it's also the 15th year of AWS. They were really pushing a lot there. And I would say the first six, seven, 8 years of AWS, just constant price decreases within the year. At reInvent, they're saying, hey, we're cutting these prices by 20%, 30%, just constantly doing that stuff. The last 4, 5, 6 years, I'd say you've seen that a lot less. You haven't seen a lot of huge price decreases. And I think part of that is just the industry is starting to mature, and there's also just less competition on price. It's more on features, sort of completeness of offering, things like that, to where you've seen fewer price decreases. But I think you're starting to see a little bit of it creep back up. And yeah, the big one happened right before reInvent. There's a data transfer price decrease. So if you're taking data from inside of AWS and transferring it out to the public internet, they're going to charge you for that. So if that's something from, you know, CloudFront, the CDN for AWS, or even just from EC2 instances, you know, if you're serving up data directly from your EC2 instances, they used to charge you for that. They still do. But they've, I believe, significantly increased the free tier there, to where I think CloudFront now is the first terabyte is free, and with regular non-CloudFront traffic, I think the first 100 gigs is free. I think a lot of this is in response to some shots from Cloudflare, which is a separate CDN. They'd sort of been talking about how AWS data transfer was too high, and introduced some products around that with lower data transfer costs. And I think you see AWS fighting back there a little bit and decreasing some of that. So good to see. Yeah. Like, I love that as a customer, right? It's good to see whatever it takes, whether it's a little fighting between different companies or things like that. It's, you know, like you're saying, great for our wallets.
Yeah. So. Heck yeah. Go Cloudflare. Yeah. I like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I noticed another one that I think that came out during reInvent was the S3 price decrease, right? On storage costs, right? S3 is, pretty famous for being a very cheap option for storage, and in certain cases gotten even cheaper. Now, it is for standard infrequent access and one zone infrequent access, and it is in specific regions. One of those is Northern California. So if you are in that zone, you might be getting a price break. Again, that's may not be across the board, but it's still pretty nice to see for sure. And then also the S3 Glacier Flexible Retrieval. That's formerly S3 Glacier. That was, I believe, a 10% reduction across the board for that service. So that's good to see. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Great to see some of that stuff. And also, you know, if we talk about price decreases, they also had sort of an interesting one before reInvent, like maybe 2 months before reInvent, where they announced Graviton processors for AWS Lambda. So you could run ARM workloads, your Lambda workloads on ARM there, which had actually a cheaper actual billing cost than sort of the standard Lambda compute. And also they're saying it should be faster in a lot of cases. And since you're paying for length of duration of your function with Lambda, that's also going to save you there. So not only is the actual cost lower,
that's nice.
on a per unit basis, but hopefully it'll reduce your duration as well. So just kind of interesting to see some of those price decreases sneak back into the AWS announcements, and maybe just feeling a little bit of competitive pressure on some of these areas, which is great.
Yeah. No, fantastic. Excellent. All right. Let's see. Okay. Yeah, great. Yeah. Well, we covered a lot of announcements. We didn't cover them all, but we covered the ones that we liked, and that's what's most important. So
exactly. Right.
Hopefully everyone found this interesting. Obviously, like I said, there's more announcements out there. You can go out to AWS and check it out. Again, if you haven't been to reInvent and you do stuff with AWS, I'd make an effort to get out there, especially before they break it up into smaller conferences, which they may or may not do. Who knows? I don't have any inside information on that. Just, it's such a massive thing, but it is quite the experience. It's a well-run conference. Definitely. I check that out. And Alex, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate you coming on, and congratulations on another talk. And folks, if you do stuff with DynamoDB, make sure you check out Alex's Twitter. I'll have all that in the show notes and in the video description. And then he mentioned his book. A lot of great things in that book. Well received. You've got not only just the book itself, but you have video options as well. Basic tiers, very affordable, and it's a great resource if you're doing DynamoDB stuff. So All right, everyone. Thanks for listening and watching and all that good stuff. Alex, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bob. It's great to be on here and get to chat with you. So, yeah, thanks for inviting me on.